When we got to the second period, the escapements were still languishing.
The Chignik sockeye return is so low, the Board of Fisheries declares it a disaster. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 20th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the Inuit Circumpolar Council meeting wraps up in Utqiagvik.
We must become more assertive about our status and rights to effectively safeguard what is indeed ours.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Senator Lisa Murkowski and more than two dozen other senators wrote President Trump today urging that he use all available resources to reunite migrant families that were detained after crossing the southern border. Enforcement of our immigration laws should be a high priority, the senators wrote, but we must also adhere to our core values as Americans. The letter asks Trump to make keeping families together the default policy. Including Murkowski, 10 Republican senators signed the letter. Among them is Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, one of the most conservative senators, and frequent Trump critic Jeff Flake of Arizona. The list of Democrats includes Jeff Merkley of Oregon, one of the most liberal senators. Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan's name is not on the letter. His spokesman says Sullivan was not asked to sign it, but he agrees with its main points. In a separate statement, Murkowski said there are more effective and humane ways to enforce immigration law that don't require family separation. The Texas Tribune reports today that the government still has some 2,000 children over five who must be reunited with their parents before a court-imposed deadline on Thursday. In Alaska federal court, MGM Resorts International is seeking to prevent lawsuits from being filed against it related to the mass shooting in Las Vegas last year. A gunman firing from his hotel room window killed 58 people, including at least two Alaskans, and injured many others attending the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival in October. MGM owns the hotel from which the gunman shot and has filed preemptive lawsuits against the victims or family members of victims. The lawsuit filed in Alaska this week names six defendants. It does not seek any monetary award. Instead, MGM wants a judicial declaration that it was not liable in any way for the attack. The PBS NewsHour reported about 2,500 people had sued or threatened to sue MGM, and that the company responded with lawsuits similar to the one filed in Alaska. MGM declined a request for an interview, but issued a written statement saying the six of the defendants had all expressed interest in suing the company or had done so already. The MGM lawsuit says security for the festival was certified by the Department of Homeland Security, and therefore MGM is not liable due to provisions in federal anti-terrorism legislation. But legal experts say the gunman's motivations are unknown, so it is unclear if the shooting constituted terrorism and whether the legislation applies. Anchorage resident Ivana Murfitt's son, Adrian, died in the shooting, and she is named as a defendant in the MGM lawsuit. In an interview after the shooting in October, she said Adrian was a graduate of Diamond High School, a commercial fisherman, and a country music fan.
He was just enjoying life. And it's just such a terrible thing that happened. It's just a young man enjoying life, having a good time after a hard season of work.
In a text message today, Murfitt called the MGM lawsuit absurd and outrageous and said it had again brought up the pain of losing her son. The Alaska Board of Fisheries declared the low sockeye return to the Chignik River an emergency at a meeting on Tuesday. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
Like many Gulf of Alaska communities, far fewer sockeye are returning to the Chignik River than forecasted. Chignik has an early and late run. On July 20th, the two runs combined were just over half the minimum escapement goal for the date. With no harvestable surplus, the Chignik management area has not had any commercial fishing openings targeting sockeye. On top of that, some residents say that they've voluntarily given up subsistence fishing to boost escapement. Three groups submitted petitions asking the Board of Fisheries to further restrict South Peninsula fisheries because a significant number of Chignik sockeye swim through those fisheries' waters as they return to the Chignik River to spawn. At an emergency meeting on Tuesday, the Board of Fisheries considered the request. Many South Peninsula Fisheries stakeholders strongly opposed the petitions and urged the board to reject them. They argued that Fish and Game already has the authority to address in-season conservation issues and that closing South Peninsula Fisheries would hurt regional fishermen. In June and July, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game placed unprecedented restrictions on fishing in the South Unimak and Shumagin Islands. Nick Sigalkin, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Regional Supervisor for Commercial Fisheries in the Westward Region, explained that in mid-June, fishing time in these sections was cut in half. Post-June, the South Peninsula fisheries were initially unrestricted.
When we got to the second period, the escapements were still languishing, and we opted to close the Dolgoy management area so that period opening for the rest of the areas was the same, but we closed the Dolgoys.
Sigalkin said at the meeting that the early sockeye run to the Chignecks is very unlikely to meet its escapement goal, and the late run is weak also. However, it was Fish and Game's position that the situation did not constitute an emergency.
Current sockeye salmon escapement is not the worst on record for this state, and while escapement is not adequate to provide directed commercial salmon harvest opportunity in the Chignik management area, the sockeye salmon escapement level does not threaten the long-term sustainability of this stock, and the department does not believe the current Chignik River sockeye salmon escapement level or the harvest of some Chignik origin sockeye salmon in KMA or South Alaska Peninsula represents an emergency.
Nonetheless, the board approved the emergency petitions with a 5-2 vote. Fritz Johnson, a board member from Dillingham, explained why he considers the Chignik situation an emergency.
These fish are, you know, we've heard that this is the lowest return in, you know, if not in recorded history, you know, certainly in a long time with regard to, you know, the fish returning to the Chignik systems. This is an important resource, an important fishery for the communities that participate in it, and I think you know, given what we're seeing in terms of escapement, that you know, we need to address this today, now while we're here, and provide what protections we can, you know, to this, you know, to this salmon stock.
Members voted to keep the subsection of the Dolgoy Islands and the Southeastern District mainland area closed through August 8th to protect Chignik sockeye. The Board of Fisheries will further discuss management of Chignik and South Peninsula stocks at a February meeting in Anchorage. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a false alarm in Lynn Canal as a decomposing whale is mistaken for a giant squid.
A lot of researchers were getting excited about it and wanted samples. They wanted to know what they were eating.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
The Inuit Circumpolar Council just wrapped up a big meeting yesterday in Utqiagvik. Inupiat, Yupik, and Chupik from Alaska and Inuit from Canada, Greenland, and Russia got together to discuss a range of common issues and interests across the circumpolar north. The meeting concluded with the signing of the Utqiagvik Declaration, which will guide the ICC's work for the next 4 years. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig was there and has this report.
In the Utqiagvik High School gym, translators were kept busy for 4 days solid, working to translate content live into the languages of the listening audience: Inupiaq, Yupik, Inuktitut, Russian, English, and Greenlandic. This meeting happens every 4 years when the Inuit Circumpolar Council gets together to set priorities for the next term and elect new leadership. On Thursday, Alaska's own Daly Sambo Durow was elected chair of the ICC. Sambo Durow has been to every ICC General Assembly since the first one was held in Utqiagvik in 1977. This is her first time elected chair.
I am deeply humbled by the recognition and the support and the confidence that people expressed in me.
Sambo Durow is Inupiaq with family roots in Unalakleet. She's also a professor of political science at the University of Alaska Anchorage. In her closing address, she underscored the importance of Inuit engagement in global decision-making as more and more countries show interest in the Arctic.
We can't underestimate it. We've already seen the growing compounded interest and pressure. Therefore, we must become more assertive about our status and rights to effectively safeguard what is indeed ours, the lands, territories, and resources of the Arctic.
On the last day of the meeting, the ICC passed the Utqiagvik Declaration, a document that outlines some of the ways forward on issues ranging from education and economic development to wildlife management and food security. The Utqiagvik Declaration includes a provision advocating for the phase-out of heavy fuel oil, a type of fuel used in shipping that can present unique cleanup challenges, especially in the Arctic. The UN group that regulates international shipping is currently considering banning its use. James Stotts, the president of ICC Alaska, says the declaration also deals with a range of social and cultural issues. One thing that stood out to him from this year's meeting was the frank discussion of suicide, especially suicide among young people.
It's an issue that's been more or less hidden or silent for a long time. And I heard a very strong desire to bring it out into the open, to discuss it openly.
The declaration directs ICC to hold a summit sometime in the next 4 years on health and well-being that will look at suicide, addiction, and general mental health. The next General Assembly meeting will be held in Greenland in 2022. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik.
University of Alaska Fairbanks officials say a man killed himself on campus this morning by jumping from the 8th floor of the Greening Building. UAF spokesman Jeff Richardson says university police received a call about a man's body found on the west side of the building just before 10 this morning.
On the west side, there is kind of a little alcove that you can access via an emergency exit. And it appears that he jumped from that alcove.
Richardson says the man died of head trauma. He says campus authorities are withholding the victim's name until next of kin are notified. And he says no foul play is suspected.
There was a note found on the body, which makes this something that they're considering an apparent suicide.
The Greening Building is located on the east side of campus. It houses classrooms and offices for UAF's College of Liberal Arts. Richardson says an investigation on the man's death continues. Alaska Electric Light and Power's parent company says its acquisition by Hydro One remains on track. That's despite political pressure that forced the resignation of the Canadian company's leaders. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports.
Hydro One has been roundly criticized in Canada over rising utility rates. Ontario's newly elected leader, Doug Ford, had made the company's unpopularity a campaign issue. He convened a press conference last week.
I said over and over and over again on the campaign trail, the CEO of Hydro One and the board will be gone. I'm happy to say today, the CEO and the board of Hydro One, they're gone, they're done.
Hydro One had been publicly owned since 2015, but the province of Ontario still holds a minority stake, which, coupled with Ford's bully pulpit, was apparently enough to force the company's leadership to resign. Market analysts warned the upheaval could delay or even torpedo the $5.3 billion deal to acquire AELNP's parent company, Avista. The Hydro One Avista transaction requires approval in 5 states and is still being reviewed by state regulators in Oregon, Idaho, and Washington. Regulators in Alaska and Montana have already signed off.
We remain committed to this merger with Hydro One and believe it still provides benefits to all of our stakeholders.
Casey Fielder is a spokeswoman for Avista in Spokane, Washington. She said AELNP's managers will
continue to manage the operations there in Juneau, and this should not have a material impact on the customers there in Juneau.
Avista penned a 7-page letter to Alaska regulators this week, reaffirming its commitment to the deal. It stated that structural arrangements would insulate operations of its subsidiaries from changes of leadership at Hydro One. Closer to home, AELNP is celebrating its 125th anniversary this week in Juneau.
Actions in Ontario will not impact our ability to serve our customers.
Debbie Driscoll is the company's spokeswoman.
ALMP remains focused on our operations and providing clean, reliable power to the community of Juneau, as we always have been.
Market analysts say the risk to the Avista Hydro One merger remained twofold. If any one of the five state regulators declined to approve the deal, it would trigger a domino effect. The other risk is that Hydro One's new leadership team, which has yet to be named, could cancel the Avista deal. Analysts agree both scenarios are unlikely but possible. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
For a few hours Tuesday, a reported giant squid sighting in Lynn Canal excited marine researchers. But after some investigation, it was determined the alleged squid was, in fact, a decomposing whale. KHNS's Abby Collins reports.
On Tuesday morning, a fisherman called the U.S. Coast Guard to report a giant squid on the west side of Lynn Canal near St. James Bay. The Coast Guard passed the message on to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Marine Mammal Stranding Network. Since squid aren't mammals, the stranding network deferred to the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute.
They thought, well, we don't do squids, so maybe you guys like squid. And everybody got really excited about a giant squid.
John Moran is a fisheries research biologist with the Institute's Okbay Laboratories.
A lot of researchers were getting excited about it and wanted samples. They wanted to know what they were eating. And, you know, things are changing in the ocean. We've had a lot of warm water, and there's supposedly more squid around. So it didn't seem out of the realm of possibilities that it could have been a big squid.
And if it had been a giant squid, Moran says it would have been a pretty big deal.
I think it would have been the first sighting in Alaska of a giant squid. We have some other species of squid that are big, but not that big, not giant squid. And I looked up some of the information on it. It would have been a really big giant squid if the mantle length really was 30 feet. So it would have been huge.
But when a team from Moran's office went out to look for the creature Tuesday night,
they couldn't find it, and then they saw a fishing boat out there, and they said, "Oh, you're looking for the squid?" And they said, we are, and it's over there. And they drove up, and it's a whale.
A decomposing humpback whale. Moran says Noah was already familiar with this particular animal.
When you start looking close, you can see there's bones in there, and we'd been on that carcass before. There was a necropsy performed on it, so we knew pretty much where it had come from, and we had been kind of tracking it, too, that it had floated out of Young's Bay and is heading north.
Still, he says he understands how the mistake could have happened.
You don't know what you're looking at, I guess, and it is a big blob, so you can see how it might look like a squid. It's a big white blob. It looks nothing like a whale. I think the head is probably fell off, the tail fell off, there were no flippers on it, so basically it's a big white gooey blob floating on the surface, so it probably looked more like a squid body than anything else, I would guess.
And the thought of a giant squid in Lynn Canal, though rare, was not totally out of the question.
There have been sperm whales tracked almost up to Haines.
Sperm whales prey on giant squid.
And they've been seen in Lynn Canal and in Chatham, and we're kind of wondering what they're doing up there, because they're off on the shelf break out in deep water, feeding on, you know, squid and sable fish and things like that. But they have been moving into Chatham and, almost to Haines.
Moran says marine animal mix-ups like this one are not uncommon.
We often get descriptions of animals or parts of animals, and sometimes things look weird, and a lot of times it turns out just to be something that's pretty common. A lot of baby killer whales that turn out to be doll's porpoise, like that kind of thing.
So no giant squid this time, a decomposing humpback whale near the fishing grounds. Reporting in Haines, I'm Abby Collins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. SEARCH offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at SEARCH. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK,
China. Alaska does $1 billion worth of trade with China every year. It's the state's largest trading partner, but it took a lot of work to break into that market, and one man has been at it for decades. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney takes a look at the life of Yingdi Wang, the Chinese-born American citizen who's the state's go-to guy in China.
When Alaska Governor Bill Walker decided to take 50 people on a trade mission to China, the logistics were complicated. But when the bulk of the delegation landed at the airport in Beijing on our first day, Yingdi Wang was waiting there. He's this small, impeccably dressed man, and he is really, really good at logistics. He's a natural-born fixer. On this trip, that means a steady stream of rapid Mandarin to the bus driver, to staff at the airport and hotels, answering questions, solving problems, tracking down a tailor so half the delegation can get new suits. You know, herding cats and making sure people are getting where they need to go. He's up with the group first thing in the morning, out late, and on these long bus trips, he usually puts his sunglasses on, crosses his arms, and takes a nap.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm really tired, so, but I'd be happy to.
We're on this bus in Shanghai with about a dozen people who are interested in selling what Alaska has to offer into China. Wang sits in the front seat watching the horizon. He's thinking about how much the city has changed since the first time he visited in 1991.
Well, there's no highway, there's no high rise. This is, you know, like this road we're on. It's a big, big, big change. You
know? How many high-rises can we see from here?
I can't recognize in Shanghai.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Hundreds, you know.
It is just a sea of people.
Yeah, you're right.
Wang was born in 1954 in Beijing, about 10 minutes from Tiananmen Square. And it was a chaotic time. The Cultural Revolution started in 1966, and when he was 16, Wang was sent to a work camp. He worked as a welder, a boilermaker, and in a big chemical factory outside of Beijing for about 15 years. By the early 1980s, Wang was 30 years old, and he wanted more. He wanted to finish college. But he says he wasn't allowed to do that in China. So he decided to come to America, and he ended up in Alaska. John Sturgeon is a close friend of Wang's. Sturgeon. Yes, that John Sturgeon is something of a states' rights celebrity in Alaska. And let me tell you, he was really pleased to be talking about something besides his groundbreaking Supreme Court battle.
Yeah, thank you. people don't know I have a life outside my court case. I actually had a career, you know.
And a big part of that career was right alongside Wang. To this day, they still introduce each other as best friends. They met right after Wang came to study business at Alaska Pacific University in Anchorage. And like a lot of other college students, he was looking for a job.
And I had a friend that I was working with called up and said he had some college student that was looking to make some extra money if I needed my lawn cut. And I says, yeah, I really didn't, but I was trying to do him a favor. And so I said, okay. And so that person turned out to be Yingdi.
So a 30-year-old college student shows up to mow his lawn, and before long, they're working together. First in the timber industry, Wang's first job was scanning log tags by hand before they were shipped off, sometimes 20,000 tags per ship.
Yingdi would come in after hours and scan those tags till late in the evening and sometimes early in the morning.
Sturgeon says he watched Wang blossom from a new immigrant with terrible English skills into a savvy business person pretty quickly. With Wang's help, Concor Forest Products opened one of its first headquarters for an Alaska company in China. Wang ran the company's bureau from his apartment. Sturgeon and Wang don't work at Concor together anymore, but they've started their own businesses since then.
Still to this day, we don't have to put down deposits to the factories when we buy something because they trusted Yingdi. That's very unusual. Somebody, have $50,000 worth of products he would make just for you.
About 15 years ago, Wang took those private sector skills into the public sector and started working for the state. When someone from the governor's office or the Department of Commerce wants to do business in China, they call Wang. And he knows Alaska. So he steps in at these crucial points in meetings to make sure that everyone is on the same page. But that's all changing now.
How long are you going to continue working for the state? It seems like you're everywhere.
Well, I don't know. Like my age is close to retirement, right? I just,
What's retirement age? What is your age?
Well, you can calculate, you know. I was born 54. You know,
he's 64. This summer, he's leaving behind that apartment in Beijing and settling in the U.S. for good. For AK, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Benino Achis in Kodiak. Achis works with drug rehabilitation at Safe Harbor and immigrated to Alaska from the Philippines in the mid-90s.
I come to Kodiak because that's where my mother-in-law and the husband already here in Kodiak, but actually they originated from Hawaii. They come to Kodiak due to work in the cannery. I worked for 3 months when I came here, you know, but after that, you know, I keep on looking for a job and then I get, you know, the job that I want to, but I don't really stay long for that job because from the cannery, I used to work as a correction officer in the city of Kodiak, but I don't like the job because I've been in the military and the police force when I was still in the Philippines and the setup is different from here. In the Philippines, we only have 2 seasons, dry season and rainy season. Here we have 4. And at that time when we arrived here, you know, the snow is really, you know, thick, you know. It's like, I remember one time, you know, during it's like Thanksgiving and you cannot go out from your house because, you know, it's full of snow outside. We have our own, the Filipino American Association of Kodiak. Me, I am the one who organized Filipino youth movements against alcohol and drugs. This is one way, you know, to help the Filipino American youth, you know, get away from the dangers of alcohol and drugs in this community. I usually have my own team for basketball with the young kids. We used to travel from Kodiak going to Anchorage to play against Filipino teams in Anchorage. That's my passion, you know, travel with kids, you know, and play sports.
Benito Achis lives in Kodiak. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Rasha McChesney, Daisha Eaton, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Avery Lill in Dillingham, Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Jacob Resnick in Juneau, and Abby Collins in Haynes. Wesley Early is our producer, Dave Waldron is our audio engineer, and I'm Casey Grove.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.